Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today, I'm joined by our editor-at-large and calamity-walking, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Jane. It's a lovely welcome. I'll have you know I've had no calamities for at least 48 hours, so this is a new record.
Amazing, amazing. I say this because obviously you do have a column called It Shouldn't Happen to a Film Journalist, where calamities do befall you in junket situations and on sets.
They do. I'm a very unfortunate person, I feel. Very fortunate in other ways, but I am one of these people who, if I'm walking along and I walk under, you know, someone on a roof doing some tiling or something, they will choose that moment to drop their hammer and for it to land on my head. I'm kind of a walking Buster Keaton, you could say. But such is life. I quite enjoy it, actually.
Well, let's hope that none of that Buster Keaton-esque bad luck befalls us today, because we are talking about a lot of stuff. We are talking to Billy Eichner and Luke McFarlane about their gay rom-com Bros. Plus, we're reviewing that. Plus, Me Too, Black Comedy, Triangle of Sadness, Horror Barbarian, and the re-release of John Carpenter's The Thing. But before we get onto those, Jamie, what have you been watching this week?
Mainly horror films.
Oh, shocker.
Shocker, no. It's the lead up to Halloween, obviously, so there's quite a few popping up here and there, which I'm trying to mop up and keep on top of. Apart from that, I'm doing one of my typically mad things. You know me and being obsessive. It's coming to that time of the year. We're being asked for our top 10 films of the year list. So what I'm beginning to do is all of my favourite films of the year, I'm watching them again, because I firmly believe you have to see a film twice to really kind of measure its worth. Some films really grow on a second viewing, some films really fade. And also, you know, films we saw in January, February, March, it's a long time ago now.
You can't remember a damn thing about them, can you?
In hundreds of films since, so I'd want to go back and sort of have another look. So I'm just taking my sort of top 15, 20 films of the year, and I'm trying to give them all another watch, just to kind of put them in some sort of order. Having said that, there's some of them I've seen multiple times already. I've seen Top Gun Maverick 4 times, and I've seen Nick Ram 3 times, and a couple of others twice. So I'm not having to go back to all of them, but I'm trying to, all the ones I've seen once, I'm giving another view.
I couldn't watch Nitrum more than once. I don't know how you've managed that numerous times. It's just such an uncomfortable film, and I don't think it's all that.
I absolutely adore it, obviously, because I'm talking about it among my best films of the year list. But it is very, very uncomfortable viewing. It's a real downer. Having said that, I think it's really responsibly made. I think, you know, they don't glamorize it at all, and they don't name names, and they do everything they can to sort of not put a spotlight on this real life killer in a way that people may be kind of, you know, flock to it or be influenced by it or sort of, you know, give him any sort of infamy in a way. But I think it's just a really well-made film about a loner and kind of looking at how he may have come to this place in life and if it could have maybe have been prevented at various stops along the way.
Well, speaking of films that have sort of changed in your mind, have you had, no spoilers on any films particularly, but are there ones that have changed in your list of your top 10 as you've rewatched them and have gone right down or have gone right up?
Not yet, but I've only just started the rewatches, so I've only done it for about 4 films. But you do sometimes get that. You know, I've had it before where a film that you absolutely adored the first time, you watch a second time and think, actually, it's not all that at all. I had that a few years ago with 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, that the first time I viewed it, you know, I just loved Frances McDormand in it and the dialogue, and I kind of went with it completely and thought it was great. I think I reviewed it and gave it 5 stars, and then I watched it again.
Wait a minute, has he got a chewy toy?
He has. That's Gene, my dog. He's sitting beside me like he always does when I do a podcast.
And you take the chewy toy off him.
He's got a new red squeak ball. Genie, come here. Where's your ball? Gene, where's your ball? Bring it here. No, he won't. He's not coming. I think he stopped. We'll give him one more go.
Okay, go on then. Which you thought was great.
Great, the first viewing. And the second viewing, I kind of had more problems with it. And thought I'd been wildly overboard to give it 5 stars. So it does happen sometimes.
Yes, the shame you feel when you realise, oh, I might have over-egged that pudding with my star rating.
You can get a bit excited in the moment, you know, especially at film festivals. I think a lot of people do this. They go to a festival, they're away from home, they're sleep deprived, there's all these different things going on, and then they sit down and see a movie that they're massively excited about because you're literally the first person in the world to see it, the first time it's been shown to an audience, and you can feel the buzz in the room and the hype, and all this can go into. Sometimes you can walk out, I think that was great, you know, and you get this at festivals that loads of critics give films 5 stars and say it's a masterpiece. And then 6 months later, when it plays in London and people go along in a more sensible frame of mind, they go, what the hell was everyone on about in Cannes? That's not a masterpiece. You know, it's a 3-star film. It's perfectly fine. So it does happen. But obviously you try to not let it happen because it's your job as a film journalist to be on the money and kind of, you know, give an informed opinion and be objective and an opinion people can trust. But obviously we're all human. So occasionally it slips away.
Indeed. Okay, well, shall we see then whether we've got it right on the next film we're going to talk about? It's time to get romantic and saucy with this.
You met a guy?
I don't think I'm his type.
He's like gay Tom Brady.
What are you into? One of these ripped idiots with no opinions?
No, I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
And I bet he's as intimidated by you as you are by him.
I'm down for whatever.
Yeah, I can do whenever and I can do whatever.
Cool. Whatever, whenever. GIF of Michael Scott dancing.
Office GIF? This person isn't gay.
This is Bros, which is written by and starring Billy Eichner as a museum curator who's given up on finding love but discovers unexpected connection with Luke McFarlane's lawyer at a nightclub. Before we get into it, let's hear what Billy and Luke had to say when Emily Garbutt sat down with them to discuss sex and box office.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of big studio movies these days are pretty sexless, but, you know, obviously Bros doesn't shy away from its sexuality. So what was it like filming those sex scenes and writing them as well as you were a co-writer, Billy?
It's funny when you're writing them, quote unquote, you're looking at it as a writer and what the story needs and what would be funny. And you're not thinking about the fact that, oh, I'm also acting in it and I'm going to have to do these things. Yes. Not to mention I have to do them with friggin' Luke McFarlane. And so you don't think about it, and then you get to set and you're like, oh shit, we have to do this now. But we were always really comfortable with each other, and I think we also really understood how and why those scenes would work as well as they do if we really committed to it. Yeah. You know, that there is an explosive nature to them, explosively funny, also sexy, romantic, and it required us just diving in and doing it. And luckily, we were both on the same page about that.
I remember Nick, our director, kind of like these very vague ideas of what that sex scene was going to be, including like sort of like it started off with a shoving match. And then like he was like, oh, maybe like, you know, you could like, you know, flex. And I was like, I get it. Like, stop. Like, you don't need to tell me this. Like,
we're the gay ones.
We're the gay ones. Yeah, totally. I feel like he was probably based on conversations that he had with you.
Probably. You know? Yes. Yeah. Yes. And we improvised a lot in those scenes and tried a bunch of things. You know, a lot of it was on the cutting room floor. Some of it made it into the movie. But those scenes, especially that first one, you know, and the other, all of them actually work really well. You know, whether they're there for comedic purposes or just to show the characters getting more intimate and allowing themselves to be vulnerable.
Yeah, the things kind of go wrong when you're filming, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we actually both did get injured during Bros. Yeah. You know.
Different scenes.
Different
okay.
scenes.
Okay.
Yeah. I got injured. I jammed my finger when we were wrestling in Central Park.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Very traumatic. Yes.
I very sexily fell off a pogo stick. And tore my ACL and then cut the scene. So it was very memorable.
The things you do for art.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good anecdote, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the movie also kind of lovingly pokes fun at Hallmark movies. And obviously, Luke, you've been in Hallmark movies such as Sense, Sensibility and Snowballs and A Shoe Addict's Christmas were some of my favourite titles that I saw when I
think
was...
It's Sense, Sensibility and Snowmen. But Snowballs.
Fire me.
Snowballs on its own.
I love it.
Snowballs.
I made it more gay.
Yes, you did.
So were these jokes already in the script or did you kind of add them in after Luke was cast, Billy?
No, it's so strange, but those jokes were already in the movie before we cast Luke. It's so funny. And I don't even think when Luke first auditioned, I realized he had done all those Hallmark movies. Yes. I knew from him from Brothers and Sisters.
Yeah.
I knew he had done them, but I wasn't aware to the extent.
He might not have cast me.
No, but I always say, you know, you can't really spoof something well unless you're secretly at home watching it and loving it. And I actually do like those Hallmark movies. And I think they, because Hollywood, mainstream Hollywood, you know, and major studios have basically stopped making romantic comedies. Yeah. I mean, not nearly to the degree that they used to. Universal just put out two, but that's very rare. I think there's a void to fill in terms of romantic, comforting, uplifting movies, which speaks to why those Hallmark movies, for all the jokes we make about them, are so popular.
Yeah, and they are very popular.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Not quite caught on here, I don't think, to the extent that they are in the US.
Yeah, they're hugely popular in America.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So yeah, speaking of the casting process, what was that like? You know, did you have to sort of do chemistry tests between the two of you?
We didn't call them chemistry tests. Luke just, you know, came in and auditioned, and we really didn't know each other. And it was pretty obvious right off the bat that maybe because we didn't know each other that well, that there was some mystery there. There's a little spark there. I think I wrote the movie, so I understood my character. But he also, right off the bat, really understood what our dynamic was supposed to be. And I think kind of understood, you know, like why and how Aaron appreciated me. And Bobby, and also who Aaron was underneath. And it was just pretty obvious from the beginning that he was the best one.
I really wanted the part really, really, really badly. As soon as I read the script, I really wanted the part for sure.
So why do you think that the movie, I guess, didn't connect maybe as much as you were hoping to with audiences in the US? And do you think it'll fare any better in the UK?
Connect is a funny word.
Yeah.
I think it did connect. I think it absolutely connected.
Well, it connects with the people who saw it, you know.
Yeah, of course,
I think that, you know, Bros at the movie theater was always going to be an uphill battle. You know, you have an R-rated gay rom-com with an all openly LGBT cast, which we were so proud of and are so proud of. But, you know, one that, you know, doesn't feature Julia Roberts and George Clooney and big straight movie stars, you know. And there's a reason for that. Hollywood, up until very recently, has not created an environment where you could have a lot of openly LGBTQ movie stars. So if you're never going to make an LGBTQ movie star, how are you going to have one who can open a movie at the box office? But, you know, I think it's, you know, the audience that does go see the movie tends to really love it. It's one of the best reviewed movies of the year. The audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, even higher than the critic score. And, you know, now it's already started streaming in the US, and already we can see a lot more people are discovering it. It just seems to be a genre of movie that, with a rare exception or two, is one that people now prefer to watch at home. I think the fact that it is R-rated gay material also is possibly a reason why people are more comfortable watching it at home. And we just want people to continue to discover it. And I do think it's a movie that will have a long life, because it's a movie that, when people actually do see it, really enjoy.
No one's going to question, like, why did you see Top Gun? You're going to see Top Gun because you kind of know exactly what you're going to see. By choosing to go to Bros, you're sort of saying something about, like, what you support, what you find funny. And those are still uncomfortable questions for people to ask of themselves, you know, whether they want to see sexuality between two men, or B, value humor as a sort of mainstream thing to do on the weekend on a date.
Yeah, and I think we're still at the point with LGBTQ content, certainly ones that require you leaving your house and not just clicking play on Netflix, which is a much easier thing to do, where because we haven't gotten many movies like this, you know, I think that there are certain audiences who just might not instinctively believe that the movie is for them, that it's something that they're going to relate to. The vast majority of the people that did go see the movie in theaters in America were gay men. You know, and because it's coming from a need to see themselves reflected, and I think many of them were gay men of a certain generation, my generation and maybe even older, who haven't had that opportunity and who didn't grow up with as much queer content as we're getting now on streaming and online. And so it depends what your perspective is going into it, but hopefully as more and more of this content gets made, the audience at large just becomes more comfortable with it and more familiar with it. That's not to say people are homophobic. That's just to say they might not immediately think that it's something they can relate to.
So that's Billy and Luke on Bros. Jamie, do you want to fill us in a little bit more about what else happens in this film apart from, you know, quite frank sex scenes and stuff about, you know, trying to do an LGBTQ plus museum?
Well, it's pretty much what you said, that you've got these two guys. You've got Billy Eichner, who's playing Bobby, who's a kind of confirmed bachelor, and, you know, he's perfectly happy with that lifestyle. He doesn't believe in love and marriage and all those things. You know, he's happy to just be a single man. And then you've got Aaron, who's played by Luke McFarlane, who is a kind of gym type bod. But Bobby meets him in this club, and Bobby is very much a kind of neurotic intellectual type, you know, and very into art and all of those things. And he meets Aaron, who is, you know, dancing with his shirt off, and he's absolutely ripped, and he's just a sort of gorgeous, gay, handsome man. And they seem total opposites, and they kind of begin to fall for each other. And this film is, in a way, it's quite a traditional romantic comedy, but it's two people falling for each other, the various obstacles. You know, you have that thing just when it looks like they've got everything together, then something happens to split them apart, and then will they get back together? It's all the usual tropes and structure, but what makes it completely different is the fact it's the first big studio film to be a gay romantic comedy, that the two leads are obviously men, and it's just unabashed, like, this is a gay romantic comedy, our audience is ready for it, which the film kind of discusses itself. The characters kind of talk about these things, and it kind of makes the point 10 years ago, audiences, mainstream audiences like middle America, wouldn't have accepted such a thing. But obviously times have changed a lot. So, you know, is the world ready for a gay romantic comedy?
Well, have they changed a lot? And is America ready? Because when this film came out in the States, it did not do well at the box office.
This is the amazing thing, because it's a really, really good film. It's produced by Judd Apatow. I think it's the best Judd Apatow comedy for many years. It's really sharp and funny and likable and romantic and sexy and everything you want in a romantic comedy. It's just a great Friday night's entertainment. But it did flop in America. It took $4.8 million on its opening weekend, when the studio Universal expected it to take $10 million. People are saying, you know, why did it flop? And all these reasons have been given, you know, from, I think Billy Eichner himself has said that straight people didn't go and see it, and he's kind of pointed the finger of blame at the fact that straight people still sadly are not ready for it. But then there's other reasons as well. You know, people have said, well, there's no star power in the film, it hasn't got any A-list stars, that maybe the marketing was wrong, that the studio kind of really pushed the fact that it's a historical romantic comedy rather than just pushing it as a really funny Friday night bit of entertainment. People are saying, well, it came out in October and romantic comedies never do well in October, and they've produced all these figures.
Ticket to Paradise came out in October.
It did, and it did well, didn't it?
Yeah, but so that's nonsense.
But people have said, you know, someone produced a list of 100 biggest romantic comedies of all time, box office-wise, and only four of them came out in October. So they were saying, well, October's not a good month for romantic comedy. Other people pointed out that loads of good streaming stuff came out in October, and Dharma dropped on Netflix, which broke all the records. So maybe people just stayed at home and watched Dharma instead. You know, there's all these reasons. It's very hard to measure. But the simple fact is, it got great reviews. It's a really fun film, which I urge people to go and see. You know, I had a great time with it, and it didn't do very well in America. So I'm hoping it does a lot better over here.
You know, that doesn't hinder a film, though, necessarily, does it? Because films do generally find their audience eventually. And these can be, you know, a grower rather than a shower, perhaps. You know, as word of mouth goes around, people will find this film. It's just a shame that it makes it more difficult, doesn't it, for the next time somebody wants to make this film, that maybe a studio will be a bit more shy about, you know, giving the budget to it, because they won't get that instant return. I agree with you, Jamie. I think it's a really fun night out at the cinema. But I can totally understand as well that it might be a bit much for some people, because it's very frank, isn't it, in its sex scenes and in its depiction of people having a good time at parties. And some people might just find that pearl-clutchingly too much.
This is the thing, and this is what I liked about the film, that when I sat down to watch it, I thought, okay, gay romantic comedy released by a major studio, they're going to pull their punches. You know, and I thought that they'd sort of sanitize it for straight audiences and worry about middle America and all of that. And they really don't. You know, they
no,
basically,
there's poppers in this, there's threesomes, there's thruples, there's, you know, all sorts of things.
All sorts. There's one line in the film, there's a couple of lines in the film which are really shocking, actually. There's one where one of the characters says, well, Jesus is gay, or Jesus was gay, which, you know, to us is a funny line, but to middle America, people are going to walk out in droves if they were in the cinema in the first place, which they weren't. And then secondly, there's the line where Bobby has to do a butt pick He's trying to hook up with a guy online, and basically the guy says, well, send me a butt pic to see if I'm interested. So Bobby scuttles off to the bathroom and gets out his phone, and he's trying to do a sort of sexy butt pic and get the angle just right and stuff. And then he decides that his ass is too hairy, so he starts shaving his ass to get it just right. And when he's shaving his ass, he cuts it. So he's got rivulets of blood trickling down his ass. And there's a line which I don't know if I can even repeat on the pod, but I will, where he sort of goes, oh, my God, he says, what am I meant to do now? I can't shit and I can't fuck. And, you know, again, that you can imagine some audience members, straight audience members and the Grey Pound and all of that are going to have trouble with a line like that. But that is what I loved about this film. It does not pander to kind of straight mainstream audiences. It's set in a real world. Billy Eichner, you know, he's been openly gay his whole career. He knows this world inside out and he's true to it. And I feel you have to have that honesty to make a good film of this sort. However funny and elevated and heightened and exaggerated it is, it has to come from a place of truth.
And he's also not afraid to be, you know, dislikable as a character as well. You know, Bobby is neurotic and annoying and, you know, blows hot and cold, holds Aaron up to ridiculous standards that he can't possibly meet. I mean, I just thought Luke McFarlane in this was absolutely adorable. Like, doesn't matter what your sexuality, you'd want this guy as your boyfriend. He was delightful. So it really works in that salty and sweet way for me. Yeah. And the fact that we actually do have somebody racing across town, you know, to declare their love, like classic. You'd expect this from Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson or whoever it is. We do get that. And it's still that snarkiness is still there, that sharpness, that waspishness that Billy Eichner brings to it that just undercuts that a little bit and makes it not cheesy. It's just delightful. I mean, I was almost in tears at points of this film. I found it so emotionally affecting. And yes, there are quotes in it that, you know, like particularly after they've slept together the first time and they're discussing sort of how they feel emotionally. And I think it's Billy Eichner says to him, you know, or he says to, I can't remember who it is actually, maybe you can correct me, Jamie. He says, you know, were you thinking about that when you were sticking your big dick in my tiny anus or something like that, words to that effect. And it's like, okay, this is not like, you know, an Anne Hathaway rom-com here. We are dealing in a totally different beast. And it kind of reminded me of Bridesmaids in a way, that when you started watching Bridesmaids and you were like, oh, this is different. This is something I haven't seen before. And this gets people on another level that I think is going to be something that people will hold on to and repeatedly watch and watch with their friends and have parties watching. And I think that's what will happen to this film. Maybe it'll have a better life on home ends.
I'm sure it will do. You know, I think, like you said, these films can grow with word of mouth. And I think, you know, the fact they screened it to a lot of people before it was released and they made a point of screening it to kind of all stripes of the rainbow. You know, they wanted to see what straight people made of it, what gay people made of it, or everyone made of it. And the scores were through the roof. And, you know, and people were laughing their heads off and had a fantastic time with it. And, you know, everyone seemed to love it. So if people give it a chance, I think, you know, most people will adore it.
Yeah. And probably, you know, you don't need to know anything about the gay community to understand the stakes that are operating here and what people ambition, you know, yearning, wanting to be true to yourself, not wanting to be tied down, wanting to be tied down. All of those things are universal, aren't they?
Yeah, completely. And that's the thing. I think everyone will find something to kind of hook onto in this film. At the end of the day, it's just a love story and it's about two people trying to find a way together through all the complications, all the Gene, come here.
Sounds like you're playing with a sex toy.
Drop it. Drop. No, that's enough. Sorry, I've got it now. Yeah, at the end of the day, this is a film just about two people trying to find love. And what a struggle that can be, you know, and it's all the preconceptions you bring to it and it's all the baggage and it's all the friends and the family and, you know, all these things that can get in the way. And regardless of your sexuality, you know, you will watch this and it's just universal. You will connect with it. You will recognize things in yourself and you'll have a great time. You know, I guarantee it. You have the Jamie Graham guarantee. Go and watch this film.
And if people don't, can they, you know, email you and tell you that?
Yes, if you don't like it, you can contact me on Twitter and call me a fool. I'm not going to give you your money back, but I'm quite happy for you to have a go at me.
Okay, so there we go. That is the guarantee. You can call Jamie Graham a fool if you don't have a good time at Bros, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, shall we move on then to something a bit more arch? All aboard. It's cruise time now with this.
The sails. Do you think it's possible to wash them?
I don't think that's possible, ma'am, because this is a motorized vessel.
Yeah.
So we don't have any sails.
It was sails. Yes.
Well then, in that case, we will clean the sails.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay, so this is Triangle of Sadness. So I don't know how you're going to sum this up, Jamie, but go.
I'm going to give you the very bare outlines because it is a tricky one. It's basically a satire about class and about the fashion industry and wealth. And our way into it is at the start of a film, we meet a male model called Carl, who's played by Harris Dickinson. And he has an audition which doesn't go particularly well. And then he goes out for a dinner with his girlfriend, Yaya. And at the end of the dinner, she kind of pushes a bill towards him and says, "Oh, thanks, honey." And this starts an argument about the fact she expects him to pay for the dinner, even though she earns a lot more money than him. And this argument goes on and on and on for about 10, 20 minutes. You know, it becomes funnier and funnier and then gets to the point it's not funny anymore. And then it's funny again. You know, it's really extended. And then anyway, they end up going on a luxury cruise that Yaya gets, you know, as a freebie because she's an influencer. And she takes Carl along and they go on this luxury cruise where they are the best looking people on the boat and also the poorest people on the boat. But it is just full of very, very super rich people. There's a Brit couple who made their money from grenades and landmines. There's a Russian kind of billionaire on the boat. And it's all these odious, horrible people. And the captain of the boat is played by Woody Harrelson, who's wonderful in this film, who's a kind of boozy captain who's having a bit of a breakdown and won't come out of his cabin. And it's really hard to sum up because there's not really a plot. I mean, what happens is it's just all these sort of different vignettes of terrible things happening, which kind of satirize the super rich. And then in the third act, the film takes a massive left turn, which I don't want to give away, but it kind of goes to a completely different place. So it kind of keeps you unawares.
It sort of reminds me of The Menu, which we saw at London Film Festival, in as much as it's very much about entitlement. It's about wealth disparity and, you know, the massive widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. It's about, you know, the unseen class of people who service these people and their actual skills compared to these wealthy people who don't even know whether their boat has sails or not. The idea of these people being on this incredibly expensive boat where their every whim is catered to. And that includes, you know, if they want the sails on the boat cleaning, even if there aren't sails, they will be promised that they will be cleaned, is ridiculous. And then also you've got this idea of the characters you mentioned at the beginning having this very uncomfortable conversation about money. And it's that idea that we all worry about money. We all know about money. We all deal in money, but we don't talk to each other about it. It's one of the things that is almost the most taboo thing to discuss with each other. So the fact that it opens with this very frank conversation about who will pay for dinner, which I absolutely understood that conversation, because you have that conversation when you go out with your friends, and, you know, one of them has forgotten their purse every time, or one of them always says, "Well, I didn't have the salad, so I should have £4 off," whatever it is. And you're like, "God damn it." It's one of those conversations. But then to have it then played out in this wealthy boat is quite brilliant. And you didn't mention, but one of the key scenes in this is when that boat literally goes into stormy waters and they're trying to have this captain's dinner, which is this elegant dinner, which is supposed to be the height of sophistication, as this boat is roiling and as their stomachs are roiling. And whilst the water's splashing up against the side of the windows and somebody's squeegeeing the water off the windows so that it looks nice, but they're actually on the cusp of extreme seasickness. So there's this grotesqueness to it as well, of the fact that these very elegant people are still going to poo and throw up like anybody else, and it's going to squill around the corridors. It was a real hit in Cannes when it came out. People really enjoyed this. And this is from the same guy who made The Square, which he obviously enjoys these uncomfortable discussions. Yeah. The thing I think about it, I would say, is that it sounds like it's very arch and, you know, cerebral. But in fact, it's a damn good time as well, isn't it? This is a funny film.
It is a funny film. I mean, I mentioned earlier in the final act, it sort of takes a left turn and goes somewhere else. I didn't like the final act as much as the first two acts. I've got to say that. It's a long film and I feel it could have been kind of truncated and that last bit could have been shortened. But having said that, it is a really entertaining movie and it won the Palme d'Or.
Yep.
Which a lot of people think, oh, you know, a Palme d'Or winning film, it must be very serious and it must be art house and all of that. But it is a lot of fun, like you said. And that scene you referred to, the formal dinner, the captain's dinner. I mean, this is what everyone was writing about in Cannes. They just couldn't believe it because you have just got vomiting and pooing going on left, right.
People are sliding from one side of the boat to the other in their own effluence. I mean, it's incredible.
It really is. It's like the Mr. Creosote scene in Monty Python. You know, it's just, it doesn't hold back. And it's just everyone barfing everywhere. And which may, again, be a bit much for some people. I could see some people walking out the cinema or maybe vomiting in their own lap into their popcorn. But it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I really liked Woody Harrelson in it as well. I love the fact at the formal dinner when everyone else is eating like lobster and God knows what, he sits down to a cheeseburger and fries. You know, it's good stuff. I mean, the director is Ruben Östlund, who's the Swedish director who did Force Majeure and The Square. It's his second Palme d'Or, you know, The Square won the Palme d'Or as well, 2017. So it's amazing. I mean, is it a good enough film to win the Palme d'Or? I haven't seen all the films in Cannes this year, but I think it's one of the weaker films, maybe.
Oh, shut up. Are you saying that a film that's entertaining can't win the Palme d'Or, that it has to art house curiosity that only you like?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that I don't think of the Cannes films I've seen this year, I think it was quite a weak Cannes this year. And compared to some of the other winners, you look down over the history of Cannes and the Palme d'Or winners like Apocalypse Now and Taxi Driver and you could name loads. I don't think it's of that ilk, of that standard. And no, it doesn't have to. I'm not saying it because it's entertaining. I love the fact it's entertaining. Pulp Fiction won the Palme d'Or in 1994, and that is an absolute blast, you know, absolute blast. So I'm all for entertainment winning the Palme d'Or. I'm just surprised in a way. I'm surprised having seen it. I liked it, but I think it has got problems. I found the satire a bit kind of heavy-handed and obvious targets. I think it's very, very easy to take the piss out of the fashion industry and out of rich people. You know, that's not hard. So, yeah, but I did like it. And like I said, the first two thirds I particularly liked, but I think it kind of slipped away for me. I mean, without giving away any spoilers, what did you think of the final third?
It's very Lord of the Flies, in as much as it's very obvious what's going on, and it is hammering home the points that have already been made quite subtly. I think the most successful part of this film is the first part, which is between Yaya and her boyfriend and the sort of the transactionary nature of their relationship and the microaggressions of that, and also the sexism that's inherent in it in the fashion industry as well as within their relationship, that is just sort of inescapable. So from a subtlety point of view, it's really deliciously sort of subtle on that first bit. Then it gets broader as we get into sick and poo swilling around. And again, as you say, it's really easy to take the piss out of rich people who just, you know, live on champagne and demand people get into jacuzzis fully clothed because they want them to. And then it goes to this other level where all of those politics that we've seen so far are played out. And yeah, maybe it's heavy-handed, but I think it is really interesting then to see how people use their skills, socially, attractiveness, whatever it is that they've displayed in the first two thirds of the film within that environment. And you definitely put yourself in the position of some of those characters, I think. Yeah. But yeah, final third, is less successful. But then it leaves it on a cliffhanger, and I also enjoy a little cliffhanger where you can watch this film, go down the pub afterwards and discuss what you think happened and what did that character do next.
For me, the best scene in the film, apart from the vomiting and pooing, which I enjoyed immensely, but for me, the best scene in the film was when the super rich woman, the older woman, says to one of the kind of helpers on the boat, who's obviously from a much poorer class, she sort of says, oh, come and have a swim in the pool with me, you know, take the afternoon off, just have a swim. And it's really subtly done about those kind of power lines that this woman, the helper on the boat, feels she can't have a swim because she's not meant to mingle with her guests, and, you know, and she's certainly not meant to be in her bikini and, you know, during working hours having fun in the pool. But at the same time, she has to do what this woman tells her to do, because this woman is the person she's looking after, and she's rich, and you don't say no to the wealthy clients. And just the power play at hand there was just really delicately done and really kind of unnerving. It made me feel quite clammy with sort of like, oh God, I don't like watching this. This is like really anxious. It had its great moments, definitely.
I mean, I called it a Me Too film at the beginning of this pod, because I think that scene massively demonstrates the power dynamics that go on, that, you know, that women have complained about. And just because it's a woman exercising her control doesn't mean that you know, it's not the same sort of similar thing. You know, a lot of the sort of Me Too movement is about calling out this idea that people in power exerting that, whether it's sexually or career-wise or politically, over people who don't have as much power, and the impossible position that you find yourself in. And that, yeah, as you say, that scene really demonstrates, you know, what that might be like if you're in that situation. There is no right way to proceed. There's no way around it. You are cornered. So I like that. But also, it is a Me Too film as well, in terms of, as we talked about, without giving spoilers, we do see a sort of power change within the sort of genders as we go along in this film, and what would happen if that came about, and how would people who'd constantly been undermined and put down behave if they were suddenly powerful. So I think it's just really, really interesting and might promote interesting pub chats.
I'm sure it will. And just finally, you mentioned about the meal at the start of a film and arguing over the bill and kind of how awkward it is, and we've all been there. I had a classic one on holiday recently. My annual meeting with the lads, there's five of us, and we went down to Lyme Regis, and we went out for a meal, and I had a pizza and a tap water, because I don't drink alcohol anymore, and I didn't want any more caffeine, so I just had a tap water and a pizza. The pizza was £9. And they were all on the beers and on the wines and on the shorts and God knows what else, and had their meals, and the bill came and they split it, and it was like 70 quid each. And they said, right, 70 quid each, everyone put your money in. And I hate saying things. I feel so awkward and so nervous, but it's like I had to say it. And I just said, 70 quid, like mine was £9. And to be fair to them, they then instantly said, oh, yeah, of course, of course. And they resplit the bill. But you know, it's just such a nasty, awkward thing to be in, isn't it?
Well, discussing money
is terrible.
Really, I mean, terrible. I wanted to discuss my salary, and I asked a colleague who is a similar role as me, who is male, what was he paid, in order so that I would know if I was being underpaid or not. And he refused to divulge, because money is a really tricky thing to discuss. Yeah. But yeah, having said that, I really hate it when you go out with people that do partake in all the booze and everything else, but then say, but I only had one glass of wine, and then I only ate like one crouton over here.
That's the thing.
It's like, it's fine if you're going to be like, here's the pizza, and then I'm going to drink tap water. But if you're going to partake and then start to micromanage how much of that, and then like, well, I think it should be about £3 off of that, because I only ate one sprout I didn't have the gravy. And it's just like, oh my God, that is infuriating.
That is rage inducing.
So the answer is not to go out for dinner with anyone, isn't it? Just stay at home, eat beans, watch Netflix, don't go anywhere.
Basically, cut yourself off from all humanity.
So you don't have to discuss money with anybody.
Just live a completely lonely life. Maybe get a dog. You'll be happy.
Yeah.
That's my advice.
We should mention before we finish talking about this that Shalby Dean is amazing in this. She's absolutely you know, luminous in it, and unfortunately died very suddenly from an illness in New York a few months ago. So this is pretty much her only sort of film, and what a film to have made.
Indeed, and it's really tragic because a lot of the reviews coming out of Cannes rightly kind of pointed to her. And they were saying, you know, what a performance, and she's going to be a star, and it's all up, you know, it's all uphill from here in terms of ascending the ladder of success. And then she got some sort of horrible, mysterious viral infection and passed away, you know, very young. So just absolutely tragic.
So worth seeing just to see her and pay tribute to what she might have been. Harris Dickinson, also good. He was in Beach Rats. He sort of made a splash with that. I think he's really great in this, the sort of aggro that is written on his face as he tries to negotiate through this terrible dinner and also through this cruise and then onward. I think he's really good in this as well. But as you say, go for Woody Harrelson standing at an angle on a boat that's tipping whilst he just drinks away and drinks even the Russian oligarch under the table is quite the thing to watch. Okay, so if you fancy Triangle of Sadness, which is, by the way, the triangle on your forehead between your eyebrows that looks a bit sad sometimes, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, let's move on from social horror to the visceral kind. It's this.
Yeah.
This is 476 Barbary, right?
Yeah, I'm renting this place.
No, I booked it a month ago.
Are you sure you have the right place?
Yeah. What am I supposed to do?
Why don't you come inside and we'll call these idiots. Why don't you just crash here?
Oh, no.
I don't know if you got a great look at this neighborhood, but I don't think you should be out there by yourself. Such a cozy. It's dry and there's a lock on the door.
By the way, I'm Keith.
Tess.
You take the bedroom and I'll sleep out here on the couch.
So this is Barbarian, Jamie. This must be right up your street, or right up your street and down a dark hole, an underground subterranean sort of prison.
Don't give too much away. I absolutely adored this film, but before we get on to why, let's just give, again, a brief outline of the plot, because it really is a film you want to go in knowing nothing about. That is the joy of this film, that it takes you on a journey. You never know where you're going to go. You go down rabbit holes. You go on wild.
I'm going to contest you on that later, but carry on.
Okay, that's good. Okay, well, let's start by saying that Georgina Campbell plays Tess, and she turns up to a rundown neighbourhood of Detroit one night to the Airbnb she has booked, and she goes to get the key out of the lockbox and there's not a key there, and it's like, what the hell's going on? And then she finds out there's a guy in the house, Keith, played by Bill Skarsgård, who of course played Pennywise the Dancing Clown in It, which should immediately set your alarm bells ringing. And she's like, what are you doing in my house? I've booked this for the night, for the week or whatever. And he's like, no, I've booked it. And he gets out his booking reference and everything, which was booked through a different site. And it turns out it's one of those kind of mix-ups that they've both booked it at the same time, and it's a complete disaster. So what are they going to do? At first, Tess is going to just get back in her car and leave, but it's a really dodgy neighborhood. It's late at night. She's tired. Keith says, don't be stupid, come in, we can share it for the night, I'll sleep on the sofa, he's a perfect gentleman, you have the room. She's obviously very nervous about it, but doesn't quite know what to do, gives in, goes into the house, and they kind of feel their way around each other, and, you know, it's quite scary and unnerving, and there's a real sense of, like, could something horrible go wrong here? You know, after a few drinks, it turns a bit flirty and all of this. But anyway, that is where I'm going to leave it. I'm not going to say any more, because where you disagree, obviously, Jane, but where you think it's going to go, it doesn't go, and it goes to different places indeed. And that's what I loved about it. So please just go in knowing that's all you need to know. Just go and watch it.
For me, it's quite a standard watching somebody make silly choices. This girl is going for a job in Detroit as a researcher for a documentary film. I would have thought that meant she was quite good at researching, but apparently not. Researching the neighborhood that her Airbnb is in, which frankly doesn't anyone do that. If you're going to a town you've never been to before, don't you just check that you haven't accidentally booked somewhere in like the worst part of town, especially if you're a woman on your own. But no, she does that, turns up, and then, you know, oh no, there's a conference in town, she is told after checking one hotel. That's what Keith says to her. Check a few more, love, before you believe the random guy who's played, by the way, by the guy that played It. He's creepy. I don't care what you say, he just is. Bill Skarsgård brings creepiness with him to any role he plays. And I think, I mean, the thing that's good about that is that you definitely get that sense of, should you trust this guy? Because you have this creeping sense of he could be an absolute psycho. So it works really well on that sort of, what should you do? Should you stay? Should you go? They have a discussion about whether she should drink the tea that he's made, because frankly, she hasn't seen him make the tea. So all of that is really good. I love that. But then we get this catalogue of errors, which I understand. It's a trope. Girl goes into creepy house, does things that maybe she shouldn't, you know. But there's a mistake with a door made twice, which is infuriating. And this idea as well of people who are so good, and this is maybe says more about me, but people that are so good that they've witnessed absolute horror and they know they've left someone behind there and they go, oh, we have to go back for them. No, we don't. No, we don't. We're just going to turn up to a hospital and make the authorities deal with that. We're not going back into that. I never understand that when it happens in a film. So for me, I was just like, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I'd just be running. We do have this situation where, without giving out any spoilers, help is sought and is thwarted by quite a clever sleight of hand in terms of how somebody is perceived within this neighborhood, which I liked. But essentially, Jamie, this is all of your favorite horror movies all rolled into one. And I think some of the subtext is really clever and some of the people that are put into these situations are really clever. But I'm not sure that it's very unusual or surprising.
You see, I think it is unusual and surprising because what I expected it to be with that dynamic between Tess and Keith, and then where it goes, because I don't think it's giving too much away to say it suddenly hops several states away and you're introduced to Justin Long's character, who is like a Hollywood, you know, director.
Douchebag. A Hollywood douchebag.
He's a complete douchebag, real arsehole. And you're introduced to him as he's driving along the coast, you know, on his phone, giving it the old power play. And then suddenly he hears about the fact that he has been accused of sexual misconduct. So Me Too again comes into this. And obviously, you know, for him, it's his worst nightmare. And suddenly all his green lights in Hollywood go red and the projects he's working on get cancelled. And, you know, and he's getting cancelled. And he just feels like, you know, I don't deserve this. This is a disgrace. This is all bullshit, blah, 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 blah. Now, how he connects to what we saw in the first act of the film with Keith and Tess, I won't give anything away, but he comes into the story and then the story also hops back in time at one point and you meet another character several decades ago and that all ties into the story. And basically, to me, it just, you could have stopped this film at any point and I wasn't quite sure what was coming next. And as someone who watches an awful lot of films, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners do, that is a joy because normally I know exactly what's coming next. You know, films follow the same path. And yes, I get your point that it sort of rolls certain horror films together, that there's a bit of Psycho in there, there's a bit of Hills Have Eyes, there's a bit
Jeepers
of
Creepers.
Yeah, you know, it's got all of those influences in there, but I think every film has its influences. I think the way it shuffles it together is quite new and clever. And what I loved about this film is it's a Disney studio horror movie, but it is so ghastly in places and nasty, and it's got these fantastic images that just kind of stain your brain and you won't get rid of. I'll say a couple of words. I'm just going to say hairy teat. I'm going to say at this point. But, you know, again, you expect studio horror movies. They're normally so formulaic and they're just good looking teens and they're all sanitized and boring. And to the horror crowd, it's like, oh, this is so safe. But this film, you know, it's hard to believe it's a Disney film because it is really funny I'll come to that in a minute, but it's really I'm coming to that in a minute, but it's really nasty. But it reminded me, and I'm going to say it, my old favorite, and it's not in the same class as this, but it reminded me of a black humor in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. But it's almost so black and so sicko that you don't notice it. But it's almost like right below the surface. But there are loads of bits in it where I was kind of giggling and almost like choking back the bile as I giggled. You know, I thought it was really funny, but at the same time, very, very, very disturbing. And, you know, I came out of it. I hate this phrase. I think last week on the pod, you were talking about the most overused sayings in film.
Oh, are you going to say this is a love letter to something?
No, no, I'm not. And I never used this before.
It's banned. Right? Not allowed to say that.
I hate it, but I do think it's a roller coaster ride.
Oh, God.
No, I do genuinely, in that it rattles along and it suddenly goes off on these mad like left turns and you sort of leaves you with whiplash. And I just found it hugely entertaining. I think, you know, if you go along on a Friday night and you want a horror movie, I think you're going to come out of this shaken, stirred and having had a great time. I really loved it. I mean, for me, it's definitely in the top 4 or 5 horror movies of the year, without a doubt.
Ooh, well, high praise indeed. I'm not saying I didn't like it. I did enjoy it, but I don't think it's The Emperor's New Clothes. I think it's just very smart in the way that it's recycling things. You know, I mean, even some things have reminded me of The Black Phone. There's nothing I haven't seen here before. I think what is interesting is the social commentary that's laid on top of this. So, you know, when we come to the end, we realize that this is as much about sort of generational trauma. It's about, you know, disenfranchised people. It's about dying towns, all sorts of things overlaid this horror and these tropes that we're seeing. So yes, I liked the smartness with which this was done, but I just don't think you can say it's something that you didn't expect. I mean, you fully expected. And also that's what it's playing into as well, isn't it? You know, if you find a door in a house to a creepy basement, you know what somebody's going to do with that, with their little torch on their phone, aren't they? And it does go down that dark avenue.
It does. But I think, like I said, it does it in surprising ways and it kind of mixes tones and it kind of pulls the rug out from under you when you don't expect it and goes to a different place. I think it's also all the things you mentioned it being about. I think it's also obviously about kind of violence to women.
Yes.
What's it, masculinity? I think that's a big theme in it. But again, what I liked about it is this director, Zach Cregger, his name is, who is best known for his work with this comedy sketch troupe, The Wisest Kids You Know. I mean, he's done a bit of a Jordan Peele here, but he's suddenly gone from comedy, sketch comedy into horror and done it very, very effectively. But I think he's just really, really good marshalling tone. It's just, even if it's scenes of things you've seen before, and let's be honest, we've seen everything before at some point, just his placement of the camera and the way he kind of gets the atmosphere and everything about it, the way he frames scenes, I just think he's someone who knows what he's doing and he's got an affinity with the genre, and you immediately think this guy is good. You know, he's a proper horror director. I found it really scary in places. I don't find many films scary, creepy, got under my skin. Yeah, I just really liked it.
Yeah, you're not going to want to drink milk for a while, are you?
Without a doubt. Mm. No milk.
No milk. Okay, so if you want to be creeped out, do have a go at this with your friends and family. I saw it with a load of people who gasped and cried out throughout, which made the whole experience much more exciting. That is Barbarian, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Called Barbarian, couldn't quite...
I read a review because I didn't know why it was called Barbarian.
I mean, the house is on Barbary.
It is. I read a review that went into the reason it's called it and the kind of... what that word actually means and where it comes from and stuff. And I now can't remember any of it, but there is a reason. There's a reason.
Thanks for your insight, Jamie.
I know this is insightful criticism here, but there is a reason. It's quite a clever title, quite a knowing title, but it's not a title that you're meant to get in terms of the average man on the street would go, oh yeah, that's referring to that.
Well, I'm the average man on the street and I didn't get it.
So am I.
We'll Google that later. Okay, before we move on, we should draw your attention to our other podcast, Total Film's Last Picture Show, which is where we ask famous people, if they had their last night in the cinema, what 4 films would they programme and why? And Jamie's done this himself, haven't you?
I have indeed.
You have? He's not famous, but we had him on. He is interesting, I promise. But we've had Baz Luhrmann, Robert Eggers, Joe Wright. Who else we had? Craig Roberts, all sorts of folk. Yeah. So take a listen. And if you fancy wetting your whistle, here's a little bit of Robert Eggers on one of the films he'd programme.
When was the first time you saw Mary Poppins?
I don't know. I was a kid, but I watched it many times as a kid. And I've watched it a handful of times as a grown-up. And, you know, The Lighthouse has a slight nod to Mary Poppins with the weather vane shot. And, you know, you need to have some joy on your way out. So, you know, being in Britain, I feel the need to apologize for Dick Van Dyke's accent, but not his performance. I mean, I still find it more than entertaining. I get a lot out of it. I mean, Mary Poppins is a witch, you know. Mary is like scary, you know, and the banker dad's character arc is a good one. And I think, yeah, like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in the most delightful way, you know, and you can say that character is cliche, but how many Mr. Banks in the world would benefit from flying a kite?
Yeah.
With their kids.
Find episodes on your podcast platform by searching for Total Films Last Picture Show. Right, time for our final film now, Jamie. It's a good one. Get your blood in your petri dish. It's this.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gotta listen to Gary. He can beat one of those things.
So this is, of course, John Carpenter's The Thing, not the original Thing, the John Carpenter one, which is seared on my soul, having watched it as a child. Tell us what this is about, Jamie, quickly.
So very quickly, it's about an all-male research team who are in Antarctica, in their camp. So they're isolated, snow blizzards, miles away from anyone. And into their camp comes a shape-shifting alien who is in the form of a dog when it first arrives. And this shape-shifting alien can basically just become anyone or a replica of anyone. So you get to the point where they begin to know that something is wrong and this enemy is among them. But they never know. The men in the camp never know who it is. Any one of them at any point could be the alien. So as you can imagine, it's just rampant paranoia, claustrophobia, and it all plays out from there.
Yeah, Kurt Russell is absolutely amazing in this as this sort of alpha male who takes control of this situation. And in one of the scenes that is, I can't hear squeaking on a glass without thinking of it, he discovers that, you know, fire is something that evokes the alien. So he takes everyone's blood and puts it in a petri dish and puts a hot wire in that each dish. Oh my god, it's so tense. It's almost a detective story in as much as how do you find out who it is, how do you kill it, how do you trap it, can you even trap it or kill it, but also this sense of being picked off one by one. So it's a classic horror in that way. But it's interesting they're re-releasing it now, isn't it, Jamie, because it almost feels like pandemic in as much as, you know, like where in the early days of the pandemic when you didn't know who had COVID and you were like scared to like see anyone and like, oh my God, and like who's got it? Who's spreading it?
Yeah.
And then I might have it and who can I spread it to? So I find it really interesting that they're re-releasing it now.
The reason they're re-releasing it, it's 40 years old. It came out in 1982. So it's the 40th anniversary. But like you say, it fits in perfectly with what we've been through in the last few years. What I find staggering about this film, because it is without doubt one of the masterpieces of horror. You see any horror movie kind of top 10 list, it would be in there. John Carpenter's The Thing. But when it came out in 1982, it absolutely bombed.
Mm.
It did terrible at the box office. It got awful reviews. All the critics were repulsed by it. Felt the special effects were way too much in your face, gooey, horrible. They hated it all. Audiences completely stayed away. It came out 2 weeks after E.T., which obviously is a very different kind of alien movie, a lot more kind of hopeful and optimistic and, like, you know, just heartwarming. And also Reagan had been in power in America for, I think he came in the year before. So America was at a time where everyone was kind of looking upwards and had loads of optimism about the future and, you know, opportunities. And they weren't ready for a film like this. They didn't want to sit down and watch
bleak, a massively bleak film.
Downbeat, open-ended film where, you know, it's all men in beards, in parka hoods, in icy, snowy weather huddled together.
That sounds like you on a dog walk.
Yeah, it sounds like me and Lyme Regis again with the lads, actually, now I think of it. But yeah, no, they didn't want to see that. And but over the years, its reputation has grown and grown. It became a big favourite on VHS when it came out, you know, in the early 80s. And its audience has grown and its reputation has grown. And it is just an absolute masterpiece, one of the great horror movies. And the special effects, which were lambasted at the time, are obviously now absolutely revered.
Oh, my God. Incredible.
Rob Bottin, he was 22 years old and he'd worked on The Howling, was kind of Rick Baker's understudy, who did American Werewolf in London, Rick Baker. And he just went away and made things that had never been seen before. You know, the whipping tendrils, all the melty latex. Ugh. The animatronics, they're just staggering. And you watch it now 40 years later and there's the odd moment here and there where, you know, it looks a bit fake because we're so much more used to everything now, you know, we're more savvy. But still, even now, 40 years later, like 90% of the effects are just astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And this alien, I mean, if you're talking greatest monsters in movies, this alien has to be right up there. I mean, he'd be my number one, but it's right up there. It's just one of the classic monsters.
Yeah. Did you ever see this on a big screen? Or were you like that kid watching it on the VHS?
I've actually seen it twice on the big screen. When I first moved to London, I saw it. It was at a cinema and I went to see it. And then about 4 or 5 years ago in Cannes, they had a John Carpenter celebration where they got the big man over himself and they did a Q&A on stage with him about his career. And Han kind of fated him and said, you know, one of the greats, John Carpenter. And then they showed The Thing because it is John Carpenter's favourite movie of his own back catalogue. And they showed it. So I watched it again on the big screen. And even then, you know, it held the audience absolutely enraptured. Everyone was just sat there completely in that moment. We were in the south of France, boiling sunshine outside. But for 2 hours, we were in Antarctica, you know, just shivering away.
I've never seen it on a big screen. I've only seen it on VHS. Me and my brother got it from the video shop when my grandma was babysitting and conned her that it was the right film for us. And she let us watch it, wandered off to have a cup of tea, whatever she was doing. And we flipping terrified ourselves. And yeah, the head stretch that turns into the spider head was honestly one of the most horrific things I had ever seen. And I still can't watch it without, you know, a shiver running up my spine. And, you know, like you were talking about the special effects, I think the thing that's so good about that is, you know, when you watch CGI, you can tell yourself it's not real because it's so good.
Yeah.
It's so fluid. It's so perfect that you can actually disassociate from it. But when you see something that gooey and slimy and ripping and it's visceral and it's practical, it feels all the more horrific. And obviously the best line in the film is when that old spider head scuttles off and they all watch it go. It's cracking. So yeah, it's an absolute belter. I'm so going to watch this when it's back in the cinema on Friday. Okay, that's it for this week. So what's your film of the week, Jamie?
Not including The Thing, which is the film of the week and the film of any week, you know, very few films can touch it. But if we don't include that as a re-release, then I am going Barbarian because I adore it. But I really do want to give a shout out to Bros as well, because I think, you know, like we said, it didn't do well in America and it deserved to do much better. So please give it a go, and if you don't like it, call me a fool on Twitter.
I can't wait for that. Okay, I think mine would be Triangle of Sadness, just because I do enjoy slip sliding in sick. Not personally, I like watching other people do it. Right. It's time now for our Star Wars character war. Who's the best And this week, who are you bringing to the table, Jamie, of the best Star Wars character?
I am bringing to the table, for very personal reasons, Chewbacca. You probably didn't expect that. Just because he's a big, hairy monster. And that is often said of me. And my nickname at university among my friends was actually Chewy. And they used to always do weird noises at me, going, noises like that. So I've just got an affinity with the beast. And I really like him. And whenever he turns up, also his loyalty to Han. You know, I just love a beast who's got a big heart. Rough exterior, but big heart. So I'm a big fan. Big fan of Chewbacca.
So I'm going Han Solo. So now you've got to decide between the two. I mean, Han Solo is, without a doubt, bar none, the coolest character in the Star Wars universe.
It's hard to argue with that because he's just the bad boy, but also a good boy as well. You know, that kind of that cool, slightly outsider, anarchic cowboy kind of vibe. He's the kind of guy that all the women fancy and all the men want to be, without a doubt. And he brings a bit of sexiness to the space opera.
He really does. You can fancy Han Solo loads. I don't feel that way about Luke.
Do you feel that way about Chewbacca?
No. I mean, maybe I would if I was a fellow Wookiee, but no. Yeah. So you've got to choose one. You've got to choose one. What, I mean, Star Wars universe without either Chewbacca or Han Solo?
I'd have to, even though I'm
I know they come as a pair, but...
Yeah, they do come as a pair. And I'm thinking back to that scene when they both appear in the Millennium Falcon and The Force Awakens, which is just such a heart-soaring moment. But if I had to choose one for the Star Wars universe, you have to go Han Solo, don't you? He's so important to the overall arc of the trilogies.
And I know he loves Chewie, and we all do, but he could get himself another, you know, wingman, couldn't he? It doesn't have to be Chewie. I feel like Han Solo is very difficult to replace. Chewie, not so much.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, there's a lot of Wookiees out there. And to the untrained eye, maybe they all look the same, but would they all have the heart of Chewbacca?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe he has a mate who could stand in if he wasn't going to be in it anymore, you know? You don't even have to have a Wookiee. You can have anything else.
Yeah, but what? What could you have? I
mean, well, there's a myriad of opportunities. You know, like Han needs to learn to work with other people.
He does, but I'm not sure.
Which is, you know, well, his lesson in A New Hope, isn't it? Han needs to play nicer with other people.
Yeah, he does. I'll let you have Han Solo on this one, Jane. I'm not going to argue it.
Okay, so Han Solo has knocked out the Wookiee.
He has.
We now have to go with Han Solo against somebody else next week and see who's going to win. Who is next week's podder going to bring to the table? Han Solo might win out of all of this, or is he going to get knocked out against other people? Because, you know, we've not even got into Vader.
I almost went for Vader, actually. When I was a child and I saw Star Wars when I was 5 years old, first film I remember seeing at the cinema, and I came out and Darth Vader was my favourite. And when we got the little toy, the figurines and stuff, I had a Darth Vader and my parents were very worried that I didn't want Luke or Han. I wanted Darth Vader and I thought he was the coolest thing on the planet. So, yeah, it probably says a lot about me.
And maybe. Okay, so we will be putting this poll on Twitter for you to help us with our Star Wars wars.
You're a great help to us. You're a natural leader.
No, that's not it. Come on. Come on.
You're imagining things.
Am I? Then why are you following me? Fredo's gonna leave without giving you a goodbye kiss?
I just assumed he's a Wookiee.
I can arrange that.
You could use a good kiss.
If you enjoy this podcast, do subscribe. We love it if you press that button and subscribe. It makes us all tingly inside. But for now, we are going to close up with a reader's question. So this is a good one. If you could have been on set to watch one scene in one film as it happened, as it was being filmed, what would it be?
God, that is a good question, isn't it? The trouble is, I mean, there's so many classic scenes, obviously, goes without saying, in the history of movies. And to kind of witness any of them, to be on set, like, can you imagine being there, the opening of Jaws when they filmed that scene and, you know, and they were tugging the actress around. I know they did her an injury and all of that.
Yeah.
But tugging her around in the water and just being there on the beach at night, if you were watching them film that would be amazing. something like Taxi Driver, the you talking to me scene. Can you imagine being able to say to your friends, like, well, you know, when De Niro's looking in the mirror, I was just stood off to the side behind the wardrobe and
making sure not to maintain eye contact in any way.
Exactly. And just watching him do different renditions, you know, different kind of ad libs of that scene, that would be absolutely amazing. But if I had to choose one, I'm going to go for a horror movie because that's the theme of this week with our last two films being horror movies. And I'm going to go for another John Carpenter film. I am a big fan of Christine. It means a lot to me. I love that movie. And I would love to have been on set the night they shot Christine mowing down Buddy Repperton, the bully, which is a scene where Christine crashes into the gas station. It all goes up in flames. They blew up a real gas station. They built it and they blew it up. It's a full scale. And then Christine roars out of the flames and she herself is flaming and she's going down the highway at night and it's all blackness and just this lit up car roaring with flames. And she chases Buddy Repperton and runs him over. And I love that scene in the film. I think it's really iconic and just visually beautiful. And I would have loved to have seen them shoot that. So I'll go with that. What about you, Jane?
I mean, I would have loved to have seen Gene Kelly do Singing in the Rain on that back lot with all of the water coming down and see him twirling around the lamppost. I'd have loved to have seen any film where they do a really long tracking shot. So I'd like to have seen the Goodfellas, you know, the date night going down into the club and the table. And also, you know, the Atonement long scene where he walks around Dunkirk and everyone has to be in the right place and the horses have to get shot at the right time. The Player long one where that goes in and pulls in on the sort of back lot and there's all different people. So even Birdman in Iratu's Birdman with the different people in backstage. I'd love to watch one of those because the amount of times it must have gone wrong. To actually watch them get that in the final instance would be amazing. I think the euphoria that you would feel along with the crew of having got that shot absolutely right and timed perfectly would be amazing.
It would also be the euphoria because being on a film set, it sounds like the most glamorous thing in the world, but it can be a bit boring, can't it? Let's be honest.
Yes.
They do scene after scene after scene and you just hang around while they set it up again and it takes half an hour. And they do it and fluff it again and set it up again. So if you were on set of Birdman and they'd done like 12 takes, you would be so tired and hungry and had enough. And then when they nail it, it would be a wonderful feeling.
And it's also being on set of scenes that can't be stopped as well. So like stunts and things, that's where that kinetic sort of it actually keeps rolling thing happens. So, you know, if you're watching dialogue, they often cut it and stop and start and do from over the shoulder and cover shots and all of that sort of stuff. But if it's something that's like an action scene or a dance sequence or one of those things, you'd be watching film really happening in front of your eyes, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would. If you were on set of Singing in the Rain, you could have given Gene Kelly a tissue, couldn't you, between takes?
A little ibuprofen.
He was really ill, wasn't he? Poor
he had
man.
A terrible cold when he was filming that. You can't tell. You cannot
Unbelievable.
Tell.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he's so effervescent.
It would also be amazing to be on the set of Apocalypse Now when the all of the helicopters come in and the bombs are going off and it's total carnage behind the camera as well as in front of it.
That would be so scary. I mean, you mentioned earlier with The Thing, with the practical special effects that they feel real and all of that and how much more effective it is. Can you imagine being on the set of that scene in Apocalypse Now? Because that's no CGI, that's real helicopters roaring in, dropping bombs, bombs going off everywhere. You know, and that's why that scene is so amazing. You watch it and you can feel it's real. Like watching Top Gun Maverick this year, you know.
It's all real, Top Gun Maverick, it's all real.
When something is real and they're up in those planes, you know.
Oh, I thought you were saying like Tom Cruise actually jumped out of a plane at Mach 10 and like landed.
No, not that. That wasn't real, no. Anyone jumping out at Mach 10 would not have been walking into a diner minutes later.
Well, no, they might have come into a diner in a bucket.
Yeah.
In several thousand million pieces, but not just wanting a glass of water.
No, but I meant actually going up in the planes, flying them themselves, doing those stunts. You know, you could feel it. It is so much more effective.
So on that note, on this very real podcast with no special effects, we'll say goodbye until next week when we'll be back with more. Jamie, say goodbye. You can do it in the style of the Wookiee.
I'm not going to try. I was about to do that, but I would embarrass myself. So I'm just going to say goodbye.
I can't do it either.
Now, what the hell is that? Leave it. Cut it.
I think that was a werewolf rather than a Wookiee. Okay, goodbye, Jamie. And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
All the treat. Jean, come here. Stop it. Drop. No, that's enough. Sorry, I've got it now.
Who let the dogs out?
Was nice, the party was pumping, and everybody having a